Happy Friday, Truth Seekers. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, I know you're probably really maxed out on Sgt. Pepper's, but hey, you know, 40-year anniversaries only come around once every, well, you know. 40 years since Sgt. Pepper's was released? Seems like yesterday. Wait a minute, that's a different song. No, stop, Kathy. I'm going to want to just pack it in and go pour a glass of wine and fire up a doobie and spend the rest of the week listening to Sgt. Pepper and the White Album and on and on and on and on on and 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 on. I know you've heard it before, but I swear to God, we're just not making music like that anymore. We're not. We're just not. A little bit of trivia. I don't know if you knew this or not. This is in the St. Pete Times. I think yesterday, when the Beatles gathered to make that album, they told their producer, George Martin, a secret. They had decided they weren't going to tour anymore. That was it. No more live performances. They decided they were going to make music that couldn't be played live. And John Lennon when that announcement was made, when they were talking about it, when they went into the studio to start the 3 or 4 month long process of recording this, Lennon is reported to have said, "We're fed up with making soft music for soft people." So the result was Sgt. Pepper's, an album that I think a lot of people still think it reverberates everywhere, not just the music industry, but around the world. Has somebody got a mic open somewhere, Kathy? I keep hearing something like, oh, there you go. Thank you. The album was released actually 40 years ago today, June 1st, 1967, and we were talking about this the other night, kind of as a preamble to tonight. Not that we're going to do anything with Sgt. Pepper's tonight, we're just going to play a lot of it as bumper music, but it was the it was an album that a lot of people say helped launch the so-called Summer of Love in San Francisco that really lasted about one summer. that was it. The hippie thing was like one summer, and then the great American marketing machine got a hold of it. But it did so much. Album did so much. It elevated pop art to almost iconic status. We have a couple of reproductions, I have to admit, here of Moby Grape and Jefferson Airplane. Some of the groups from Fillmore West days, Bill Graham, and so on and so forth, and the art. The art was incredible. And then, of course, you had Peter Max, who, arguably, his career was launched with the pop art revolution. I like this sentence that Christopher Ave wrote in the St. Pete Times. He wrote, "Sgt. Pepper's soaring incandescent melodies, psychedelic sound textures, and juxtaposition of rock against Baroque English dance hall and Eastern idioms make up the root of its power. There was nothing soft about it." I wish I could write sentences like that. The just to put it in quick historical perspective, the Beatles had just finished a tour of the Philippines where they had seriously pissed off Imelda Marcos, who is one of those kinds of Eastern Catholics that just really can be irritating, and it was. They got thrown out of the country. In fact, the Marcos, the two of the biggest criminals in the history of the Philippines, other than the United States from our occupation and our murderous enterprise there in the Spanish-American War, but the Marcos family were probably, Ferdinand and Imelda, were probably two of the most corrupt criminals that we ever supported. We supported them for a long time, 30 or 40 years. When they got to the United States, or not when they got the United States, in the United States, because the Beatles have said that they stated a very simple truism: we're more popular now than Jesus was. Why was that so weird? How many people heard of Jesus when he was wandering on the Middle East with 12 single guys talking about stuff? How many people knew about Jesus? 1,000? 10,000? How many people knew about the Beatles in 1967? 1 billion? So I think it was Lennon, told an interviewer that the Beatles were bigger than Jesus now, and as a result over here, all the fundamentalist preachers, and yeah, we had them back in the late 60s, ordered the children to show up with their Beatles albums and burn them, stomp them, smash them. But in ending their touring, and shortly after, of course, breaking up, they could do what they always wanted to do, make any kind of music they wanted without dealing with fans. That song, A Day in the Life, I agree. The engineer during the session that put Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band together, the engineer at the time, was a guy named Jeff Emmerich. He was only 20. He was 20 years old. He said A Day in the Life was clear. The brilliance of A Day in the Life was clear from the first take. Shivers ran down our backs, Emmerich said. It was just unbelievable. So indulge us. We're going to play a little bit of music from my, not childhood, but damn near. Okay. Not even damn near. But it is difficult to believe that this album was released 40 years ago. Half our audience wasn't even born then. Or something like that. You sure you don't want to just put on a best of and go drink some wine? Nah. I got an email from Edie just about the time I saw on television that Kevorkian had been released from prison after 8 years. That's hard to believe. Jack Kevorkian's been out of circulation for 8 years? Holy cow. Edie writes, "Hi, Mike. As most know by now, Dr. Jack Kevorkian was released from prison after 8 years. He is not expected to live more than about a year due to hepatitis C, which he has had since service in Vietnam. When the history of this man and his cause is finally written, I believe he will be considered a hero, a man ahead of his time. He went to prison for assisting the suicide of a 52-year-old man suffering with Lou Gehrig's disease. Anyone who has ever watched a loved one die a slow, agonizing death should be grateful to Dr. Kevorkian. Consenting adults should not be treated like idiots, incapable of making decisions regarding what they can or should be forced to endure because of what others think. I hope Dr. K will have peace during whatever remains of his life and that he will be able to leave us on his own terms." Edie. Yeah, I kind of like the idea that was put out in the movie Soylent Green. Do any of you remember that? That was Edward G. Robinson's last movie, and who was it? Charlton Heston had the major role in that. Charlton Heston and Edward G. Robinson. And in that movie, aside from the fact of what they were eating, but when you decided you'd had enough, whether you were suffering of a terminal disease or not, as a matter of fact, you were encouraged to do this. Go to one of the termination centers and, relax, get comfortable, put on stereophonic audio and visual enhancements in the room and just drink your drink and float off. So it's going to be a weird program tonight. I feel it coming, Kathy. When we come back, Hillary Clinton in a coffin. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. I get high.
I get by. with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-two past the hour. You got to love the folks in Sacramento. I swear to God, Hillary Clinton is scheduled there for a fundraiser. Was it last night? Was it last night? And at the home of a wealthy person. Is it a well? Yeah, a real estate developer, Eleni Sakopoulos Kounalakis. Two Greek last names hyphenated. That's going to be difficult for anybody, unless, of course, you're Greek. Anyway, Stephen Piercy, who we mentioned him last year on a program, he made a human-shaped form dress in military uniform and hanged it from his, or hung it from his Sacramento home. Remember that? Remember that story, Gabby? What he did, he brought a coffin to this fundraiser in at the home of a real estate developer in Sacramento, a coffin as a means of expressing his displeasure with Hillary Clinton's stance on the Iraq war. More than 120 people were kept at bay waiting to enter this $500 to $4,600 per person campaign fundraiser. So what Stephen Piercy did, he stuck a coffin out, I guess, at the foot of the driveway leading to this wealthy real estate developer's home. He then made a statement. He said, quote, "Hillary is not welcome in Sacramento as a candidate. If you fund the war, you're keeping the troops in harm's way. She can't have it both ways," end quote. Well, here comes the Secret Service. When they arrived on the scene, they asked Piercy if they could have permission to look inside the coffin. He refused to let them do so, saying they had no probable cause for opening the casket. So the Secret Service then called in local law enforcement officials and requested a bomb inspection, right? At that point, Piercy opened the coffin. Local officials said that was not sufficient and proceeded with the inspection for a bomb. They got the damn thing open in front of him. "Now we're going to, you might have a teeny bomb in there." So they searched the open coffin for a bomb. Consequently, it said, this is from the Sacramento Bee, and it was published today. I don't know. She's writing in the present tense, but it says, finally around 8:30 p.m., and Sacramento has not had 8:30 p.m. yet, so it must have been last night, right? Finally around 8:30 p.m., Sakopoulos Kounalakis came out and ushered guests into her house using an alternate route through a neighbor's yard. She thanked guests for being patient and scolded protesters. You see, the hordes of protesters and media showed up and were kept about a football field away from the entrance to Goethe Park I guess that's where this wealthy real estate woman lives. Hillary arrived around 8:40 p.m., nearly 3 hours after her scheduled arrival. I like that. I think that's very good. So the people got all upset. They were afraid to walk past a coffin, and the coffin is a flag draped coffin. It's sitting there. There's a picture of it. If you go online to commondreams.org, you can see it. But either they were afraid to walk around it, or they didn't walk around it out of respect. I'm not sure. Well, I guess that couldn't be it because when the wealthy real estate developer came out and rescued her poor traumatized guests, she took them around or away from the coffin through a neighbor's yard. What are we going to do? Oh, God, I don't know. We play a promo on this program, and I'm sure on other programs, put together by an absolute genius who works at, among other places, KPHX. And it talks about a nation of sheep. You know, sheep don't listen, have a hard time listening to Nova M. And it's just brilliant. The young guy who does these commercials or these promos for Nova M is just one of the best talents I've ever come across. And when you listen to that, it just reminds me of these people standing around not knowing what to do in front of the house for the Hillary fundraiser. Huh? Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Downstairs to the kitchen, clutching a handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key. Stepping outside, she is free. She.
We gave her most of our lives.
Is leaving.
Sacrificed most of our lives.
Oh.
We gave her everything.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on Trampoline.
Nighty night, truth seekers. Time to snuggle up with your favorite screamer. More Mike Malloy.
In this way, Mr. K will challenge the world.
Nighty night, Mr. Kite. 25 before the hour. Let's do a couple of calls here on this Sacramento Hillary thing. Douglas. Douglas is calling from Sacramento, listening on KSAC. Hey, Douglas.
Yes, Michael. Thank you for taking me.
Sure.
It's good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Yes, I have a little bit of an update on the protest.
That was last night?
Yes.
Yeah, it was last night. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the reason the people had to go through the neighbor's yard and teeter on their high heels and, you know, like expensive dinner garb.
Right.
Past thorn bushes and things, is because the law enforcement crime scene tape was all over the front of the house.
Crime scene tape.
Because of the bomb scare.
Oh, my God.
And Ms. Zacopoulos' father is under investigation for a very questionable land deal with the city of Elk Grove. He inflated the price of a piece of land from about $4 million to $24 million,
yeah,
and then sold it at half price to the city of Elk Grove for $12
million.
After having failed to have the city annex it a year or some time ago.
Yeah.
So he did an end run around the city and palmed this deal off on the school board. So this is the kind of people who are hosting this fundraiser.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Hillary DeLay. Or, no, Tom DeLay. Hillary Clinton, that's right. Oh, my God. Well, all right. It's just too much, isn't it, Doug?
Well, I'm the guy. I told you I was a card-carrying mental defective, but I couldn't pass for a Republican.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
Every time I hear this kind of stuff, it scares me because I feel like the sanest one in the room.
I know.
It just, yeah, it gets to me sometimes, but thank God you're there.
It's astonishing. Thanks, Doug. Thanks for checking in.
Thank you. Love
All
you.
Right, sir. Take care. And Chris is calling from Sacramento, also listening on 1240 KSAC. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Mike. I'm so excited to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I was one of the six that was out there.
One of the six?
We were only six, and we managed to...
Only six? The way it was reported? Oh, my God. The Sacramento Bee, the writer, said there was a horde of protesters.
Oh, no. And it was, I had heard Steve interviewed on 1240 earlier, and so I jumped in my car, made my little protest sign, and went down there. I thought, boy, this is one of those rare opportunities. And so, you know, Steve brings his coffin to every, like, 40 protests.
Right, right.
It's very well known. And, in fact, one of the news reports even had a backstory on him. He's very well known to the press. And so I got there, and we're standing around, and the sheriff was actually very nice. And so were the guests. They were very nice. But she said, you know, we need to look in there. And first he said no. And then they said, well, we're going to have to call it the bomb squad. So he said, okay. And he had to kind of rip the American flag off because it was stapled to the coffin.
Yeah.
And so they looked in. There was nothing in that coffin.
Uh-huh.
And just because I guess he said no to begin with, they said that we still have to call the bomb squad.
Oh, my God.
You know. So Phil Angelides, he was standing with us. He couldn't go in for 2 hours.
Now, who is he?
He ran for governor against Schwarzenegger. He got slaughtered. He ran a very bad campaign, and I think he was funded by the same people.
Well, listen to this. This is Judy Lynn writing in the Sacramento Bee. Listen to this sentence. Consequently, hordes of protesters, guests, and media have been kept standing 300 feet from the entrance to Goethe Park on Rod Beaudry Way. Hordes?
No. It was,
there were
six of us. And then, just out of the blue, these young high schoolers and young college kids popped up across from us, and they were, I heart Hillary. And if you vote a Democrat into office, they're going to stop the Iraq war. It was very naive. Actually, there were more of them than there were of us.
Maybe the hordes refers to everybody who was on the scene.
Right. And there were at least, at minimum, 100 guests that were prevented from going in. And they were
well,
very
no,
nice.
it doesn't mention the counter-protesters. And besides that, the adjective, or the descriptive noun, I should say, hordes, is right before the word protesters. So one is left with the sentence that says, consequently, hordes of protesters, guests and media. But since the descriptive noun is right there in front of the word protesters, it makes you think, at least it made me think, oh, my God, they must have had 300 or 400 people there.
No. So it was a lot of fun. And I actually posted something on Democracy Interactive to another thread. There was a lot of videos. There was a woman from Indie Media who is posting videos of the people that, had to walk through the fields and the neighbors' yards to get into the house finally.
Yeah.
And, so it, I'll do it again. I have no problem with it. But the Secret Service really did make it into something that it didn't need to be.
Well, I'm glad you called in. And who is the other caller that called right in?
That was Douglas.
Douglas, yeah. I'm glad the two of you called in. Thanks a lot, Chris.
You bet, Mike.
All right, take care.
Mike.
Take care. A blog at the Chicago Tribune titled The Swamp. Listen to this. Several mothers who have lost children at war in Iraq took part in a new talk show today on National Public Radio. This was yesterday. One of them, Elaine Johnson, recounted a meeting that she had with President Bush in which he gave her a presidential coin and told her and five other families, don't go sell it on eBay. The president told her that the war goes on because the U.S. has a mission to complete. But Mrs. Johnson says she has discovered her own mission now, fighting to bring the troops home. Host Michael Martin asked Ms. Johnson, what about you? Why did you decide to start speaking out? Ms. Johnson said, my son was killed November 2, 2003. After they had my son's memorial in Colorado Springs, that's Fort Carson, I was interviewed by the Gazette newspaper, and that started it all. They said they had a mother or a person, They said they had never had a mother or a person to ever lash out at the president, criticize the president of being insensitive. So a couple of days after that, they called me and said that President Bush would like to meet me. And I said, well, okay, only at his cost, because I was not spending my money to meet him. So he flew about 100 families back to Fort Carson, she recalled. And in the room I was in, it was only me and four more other families. And I asked him questions, why we're fighting there. He couldn't answer that. I said, well, what are we fighting for? He said, to finish a mission. I said, why was my son and the rest of the soldiers on the Chinook helicopter, which was supposed to be only to transport cargoes, not humans? He said, well, he didn't know. He referred me to General Wilson, who was in the same room. General Wilson's response was that they were transporting them on that same helicopter and was shot down. They flew over Fallujah. Fallujah was always the hot spot. Common sense would have told them if you fly them over Fallujah, you should have escorts that have the equipment to detect those weapons that would attack the plane. But, you know, they're so brilliant up there in D.C. now that a mother with a high school diploma can sit down and say, okay, now I won't send them over a hotspot without protection. President Bush, he just didn't see that, and he told me it seemed like I was kind of hostile. I said, yes, I am hostile, because you sent my son over there. So my thing is, all the questions that I asked him, he didn't know nothing. And then he definitely did know nothing now, because the United States is in worse shape now than it was in 2003 when my son died. So the host of the show said to the woman, so when you left that meeting, did you leave with determination to do something, or did that happen over time? Ms. Johnson answered, when he told me, well, I said, what's the mission? He couldn't give me the answer. I said, well, I'm going to tell you what. I'm on my mission now. My mission has just begun. And my mission is to fight to bring these troops home, to take care of these troops when they get home. And then, she said, he gave us a presidential coin. Now, you check this out. He gave six of us a presidential coin. And he told us not to tell the rest of the people who were there. And then after that, he told us, now, don't go sell it on eBay. Now, you tell me, how insensitive is that? What kind of caring person is that? Don't go sell it on eBay. My God. Every time I see one of these stories, I don't know. It just stops me cold. Just stops me cold. Doesn't it, you? It's in the Australian newspaper. Barb sent it to me. The British Army Chief, former British Army Chief. There's the Beatles. I'll do the British story when we come back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Redefining anger management. It's Mike Malloy, only on Nova M Radio.
Ten before the hour on the 40th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. From Scott in Sacramento, Mike, your female caller, that'd be Chris from Sacramento, probably didn't see the hordes described in the B story since they were kept away from the area around the house where Hillary was to appear. I saw a shot on local TV of a large group of people protesting Hillary's visit. They were kept down the street and out of view for the most part. All right, thanks, Scott. Kind of clears it up there, I guess. The British Army Chief says there is no way, his words, no way the war in Iraq can be won by the United States and its allies. That's a former British Army commander. As he calls for the troops to be withdrawn, he is General Sir Michael Rose. I remember him. He was one of General Wesley Clark's counterparts in the war in Central Europe during the Clinton years. General Sir Michael Rose, who commanded the United Nations Protection Force in Bosnia, Herzegovina, from 1994 to 1995, said coalition forces in Iraq were facing an impossible situation. He said, quote, there's no way we're going to win the war, and we should withdraw and accept defeat because we are going to lose on a more important level if we don't. End quote. General Rose said announcing withdrawal date would help to dampen down the violence between Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish factions. He said, quote, give them a date, and it is amazing how people and political parties will stop fighting each other and start working toward a peaceful transfer of power, end quote. He went on to say, quote, how was it, he's referring to the American War of Independence, 1775 to 1783, between Britain and the 13 colonies, hello? He said, quote, how was it a small and extremely determined body of insurgents, thieves, and deserters, that would be us, could inflict such a strategic and potentially disastrous defeat on the most powerful nation in the world? The answer, he goes on, will be familiar to anybody who is looking at what is happening in Iraq today. Those who don't read history are condemned to repeat the mistakes of the past, end quote. Was General Sir Michael Rose on any of the newscasts tonight with his message of let's all go home? I must have missed it. This email is from George in San Antonio. My greetings from a longtime listener and NOVAM Founders Club member. The reason I'm writing is to really relate a little story you might find interesting. I'm a vet, and I had some pretty heavy surgery last May at the VA hospital here in San Antonio, Audie Murphy Hospital. Now I'm pretty used to seeing my fellow GIs with injuries, lost limbs, etc. But what I saw one night on my mandatory walk around the ward with my nurse shocked me. I saw a motorized wheelchair coming toward me. Not unusual, but as it came closer, I realized that it was a female in the chair. She was paralyzed from the neck down, controlling the chair by blowing in a tube. I asked my nurse how this woman came to be in this situation, and he told me that she was injured by an IED attack in Iraq several months earlier. He helped me back to my bed, and I told my roommate what I'd seen. He couldn't believe it either. Now, one year on, when I have appointments at the hospital, I notice more and more young women who have been severely wounded. And yes, young men too. I'm not trying to be sexist in any way. Actually, I've always believed that women could do the job as well as a man. But to see the extent of their injuries causes me an inner pain that is hard to bear. This occupation is taking a serious toll, and I believe that most Americans don't even know. I wish they would just walk into any veterans hospital on any given day, and then they would see the carnage that is happening in their names. Keep getting the word out about this miserable administration, and know that there are plenty of vets like myself out here doing our part. Peace, Mike. George in San Antonio. P.S. I never thought we would ever end up in another Vietnam, but here we are. I know what he says. I know what he means. I have not come face to face with catastrophically injured female veterans. I have with male veterans. But when I have seen women in those situations, you know, I think about Max Cleland, who I came to know here in Atlanta because we all live here in Atlanta. Or I don't mean we all live here, but I just happen to know Cleland. But anyway, to see him, the triple amputee, is shocking and just shocking enough. But to see women, and I guess what it is I hope I don't piss off any of our female listeners, but you know, women are the creators, aren't they? Men are the destroyers. Isn't that the way it's always been? I know there have been differences. Hell, I played the part of Theseus in Midsummer Night's Dream. I was going to get married who was she? The Queen of the Amazons. Oh, my God, I've forgotten the lines. I've forgotten everything. Not Hippolyta. Who was it? Who was somebody? Reg? Reg, quick. Who was Theseus going to marry in Midsummer Night's Dream? The opening lines, now fair blank. Our wedding day draws on apace. Who was it? Oh, God. Never mind. Anyway, I understand that women can be warlike. They can go to battle. I understand that. But there is something singularly scary. Seeing a woman combat veteran who has been severely traumatically injured. I hate war, don't you? Don't you just hate it? Welcome back, about 6 and a half past the hour, on this, the 40th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Why is that important? Oh, I don't know. But it is. Seems like it is. Kim, Veterans Against Torture, NOVAM founder, writes in, it was Hippolyta. I should have remembered. And Kim also sends me the first five lines. Now, fair Hippolyta, our nuptial hour draws on apace. Four happy days bring in another moon. But, oh, methinks how slow this old moon wanes. She lingers my desires like to a stepdame or a dowager long withering out a young man's revenue. Or something. It was a great play, Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a great comedy. It's a great play. It really is. Thanks, Kim. Let's grab this phone call real quick. Nancy is calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Mike.
How are you?
I'm all right. I was going to mention on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, You've got George W. Bush's alleged grandfather on there, Aleister Crowley.
Oh, the old warlock.
Yeah.
I'll be damned.
He's in the very top, second one, at the very second one in.
Oh, yeah? That's Aleister Crowley?
That's Aleister Crowley.
Oh, my God.
You get Barbara Bush's picture and his picture together. My goodness, there's quite a resemblance.
Isn't there? That's great.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, take care. Thanks, Nancy.
Bye-bye.
All right. From Ron. Hey, Malloy, I don't think it's fair to either gender to say men are the destroyers and women are the creators. There are lots of female destroyers. Lucretia Borgia, Margaret Thatcher, Condoleezza Rice. And male creators, Beethoven, Da Vinci, Thomas Edison, throughout history. There are more men than women in both categories, but that's because women have not been given as much opportunity in either category. That you unconsciously have those kind of negative attitudes toward men and positive attitudes toward women is a manifestation of the sexual stereotyping in your cultural conditioning. Oh, okay. Thanks, Ron. Thanks a lot. All right. Appreciate it. A lot of you sent this to me, and no, I can't read it verbatim on the air, but I want to share it with you. This is from, it's all over the internet, but, this is from Specialist Milo Freeman, U.S. Army, Iraq, and it was posted, yesterday at informationclearinghouse.info. It's addressed to Senate Democrats, Republicans, and American Idol viewers across the nation. You punk blank, panty-waisted blanks. You had a chance. You could have put your money where your mouth is. Could have put some ass behind all those claims of favoring an end to war. And you effing choked. Let me explain something to you. Your children, your spouses, your lovers and friends and parents and constituents are hostages to this war. They're dying for a conflict with no concrete objective. They're losing marriages and childhood moments to a never-ending cycle of extended tours. Their equipment, their morale is stretched thin. And some of them, those of us smart enough not to buy the effing hype, we're counting on you to find your effing testicles and put an end to this blank. We were counting on you to save us from ourselves, to find a way to put us to use serving our country in ways perhaps more effective in rebuilding our nation. And you effing choked. I haven't gotten the current edition of the paper in months. It's always a day behind. I don't get to check the news. I barely have the time. So what am I to think when I read yesterday in Stars and Stripes and hear about this blank? Is that supposed to tell me that my leaders, my countrymen, give a flying blank about what happens to me or my wife? Is that the message I'm supposed to glean from this stunning lack of cojones? Because I got to tell you, America, I'm not seeing it. I'm so sick of hearing this wretched war talked about in terms of victory or defeat. If we leave the terrorists win. F that. Today it's terrorists. Yesterday it was blacks or gays or Jews or hippies. Before that it was communists. Before that it was uppity colonials with secondhand muskets and pitchforks. It's always effing something with you people, isn't it? You just need your little wars to feel good about yourselves, don't you? Something to make you feel threatened. Something to make you feel heroic. Anything to make you feel like your pathetic lives are more than just you against the big black scary infinite. Well, obviously it's working. You don't magically win an occupation. It's an inevitable bleed out. We're stuck in a situation beyond our powers to fix in a country that we voted to destroy, whose history and people we neither understand nor care to try. We bought the hype, hook, line, and sinker. F victory, F defeat, any way you slice it, this war is wrong. You don't keep trying to win the game after it turns out you bribed the referees. You fire the coaches or the players responsible and you hand over the title. You take your lumps like an effing man and try to rebuild. Accept it. Hope you're happy, America. Clutch your pearls and all those dirty liberals who voted against the proposal. They didn't support the troops. Whine about all the evil elderly school teachers and librarians protesting the war on a Saturday morning outside your courthouse. But when your son or daughter or spouse or first sexual experience comes home air freight, mangled in a closed casket service by a daisy chain of 155s buried under Route Tampa, remember this. It won't be the dirty liberals who put them there. Hoo-ah. Milo Freeman, Specialist, United States Army, Iraq. If you want to see the unexpurgated version, go to informationclearinghouse.info. If the shoe fits is the title. At first, you know, I thought, well, wait a minute, Milo Freeman, is that like Minderbender from Catch-22? Remember that? Joe Heller's scathing anti-war novel from a couple of generations ago. Heller is dead now. Minderbender was the prototypical capitalist, wasn't he? He was the guy, he was the mess officer in Yossarian Squadron. And he put together a trading syndicate where he makes all kinds of profits. And as his syndicate grows, Milo includes the armies of the rival nations. For one battle, he gets paid by both the U.S. and the German armies. If you haven't read Catch-22 ever or in the past 30 years, you ought to go back and read it. You really should. Joseph Heller died in 2000. Milo Minderbender. Well, this was written by Milo Freeman, U.S. Army, Iraq. What else we got here? Oh, it's also James Risser sent me a YouTube video. It's also the 40th anniversary of Procol Harum's Whiter Shade of Pale. Not that that matters, but Violent crime rate. Here's another Iraq war casualty. Violent crime rates on the rise in the country. Apparently in Phoenix, near our home office, there's not one. There's two serial killers working in Phoenix. In Boston, homicides are at a 10-year high. In D.C., there have been 14 murders wait a minute. What am I reading here? Oh, since May 1st? Is that it? Violent crime is out of control in the country. I mean, not out of control, but it's rising. And one of the reasons it's rising, I think you all will agree with me, is that whatever money was available for like the COPS program or neighborhood watch programs or citizen involvement. And I'm not talking about citizen involvement like Sieg Heil. I'm talking about citizen involvement like the broken windows or any campaign to engage young people, plus the idea of jobs. You know why crime plummeted during the Clinton years before NAFTA kicked in? Because everybody was working. And when you're working, you're not real interested in going out mugging people or breaking into stuff or smashing things, right? But all the money has been sucked into this bottomless pit called Iraq so that Bush and his buddies can get wealthy and play their little dress-up games. So what's happening back here? Another Iraq casualty, that's what.
It's getting better. It's getting better. Since you've been mine. We used to be angry young men. We hide in the end in the sand. You gave me the word. I finally heard. You're doing the best that I can. I've got to admit.
That's not the Beatles.
Go gently into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
That's not Procol Harum either. That's Annie. Lennox.
Turn a wild shade of faith.
22 past the hour.
Shade of faith.
What else do we have here? Well, a lot of stuff, but and I realize we're not really getting tough tonight, although some of the stuff that we're reporting on speaks for itself. One of the stories our senior correspondent Chris in Minnesota sent me today has to do with the U.S. Embassy that's being built in Iraq. Oh, my God. Everybody knows about this, of course. It's going to cost, the estimate is $500 million, or over that. I think it's up to near $600 million so far. Yeah, we're leaving. Yeah, okay. Chris writes, welcome to modern-day Egypt, where the pharaohs of the country, in this case the U.S. and their various thugs, forced the plebes, everyday Iraqis, into slave labor to build the Great Pyramid, the U.S. Embassy. And what the story reports on, it says construction of the colossus U.S. Embassy in Baghdad continues, projected to eventually cost nearly $600 million. Iraq Slogger reports today that American officials have reported instances of appalling living conditions, abuse, and coerced labor among the foreign construction workers building the damn thing. During a telephone interview last weekend, a high-level project manager said the laborers had their backs to the wall and had been living 20 to a trailer. Protest over the company doing this, First Kuwaiti, which is probably part of Halliburton, the bad food, the abusive treatment from managers, unsafe working conditions were routine among the 2,700 workers. Former Army emergency medical technician Rory Mayberry says he found the most basic of medical needs missing, Clinics lacked hot water. Disinfectant and hand washing stations were non-existent. Mayberry also claims that workers' medical records in total disarray or non-existent, beds were dirty, support staff poorly trained, prescription painkillers were being handed out like a candy store, and then people sent back to work to operate heavy equipment or climb scaffolding. Oh my God. And on Tuesday, thinkprogress.org highlighted photos of the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, which is set to open in September. Now, remember, it's going to cost $500 million, more than that. The embassy will have 1,000 people. Operating costs will be $1.2 billion a year. The complex will be 104 acres, which is the size of approximately of 80 football fields. The architectural firm designing the embassy recently posted the designs for this thing on its website. And today the State Department ordered the architectural firm to remove the images, according to AP. The AP says detailed plans for the U.S. embassy under construction in Baghdad appeared online Thursday in a breach of the tight security surrounding the sensitive project. And Chris writes that in this article, he says, my favorite bit is this. Detailed plans for the new U.S. embassy under construction in Baghdad appeared online Thursday in a breach of the tight security surrounding the sensitive project. Apparently not tight enough, Chris writes. Somehow, someone got it and slipped it to Think Progress. Security can't be that tight. Next, they're going to be asking Think Progress to remove the story about how they're using slave labor. Slave labor. This is, you understand, don't you, Truth Seeker? Because I do. Only when I go to thinkprogress.org, or only when my correspondent in Minnesota sends it to me. Because I'm like everybody else, totally flying blind in this country. I don't have a news media that reports things to me. How many, let's see a show of hands, how many people knew the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad was 104 acres and would cost $500 million? Huh? Can I see some? Oh, three people. Okay, that's cool. That's why they hate us, Chuckle Nuts. They don't hate us because we own houses. Oh, man, what are you going to do? Milo Freeman. You had a chance, he writes. You could have put your money where your mouth is. You could have put some ass behind all those claims of favoring an end to war. And you effing choked. Open letter to the American people and the Congress of the United States. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
I'm feeling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, I'm right. Where I belong, I'm right. Where I belong. Still be standing there who disagree, never win. Wonder why they don't get in my door. I'm painting the room in a colorful way. And when my mind is wandering, there I will.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
Before the hour. Back to your phone calls here. Carol is calling from the quake in San Francisco. Carol, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, Nova M. Malloy.
Hey, how you doing, Carol?
Well, I called angry, and now you're playing all this cool Beatles and George Harrison music, and, you know, I'm getting into a meditative state here. And plus the jokes and the Dylan Thomas, and that, hey, I'm going to read Milo Freeman's...
It's at informationclearinghouse.info. A couple of people have emailed in, you know, where they can see it, because the unexpurgated version is a lot more effective than mine.
I want to read it with all the F-bombs in it. Because,
oh, man, it's loaded up.
Yeah, I believe, along with Mark Twain, that obscenity provides a release that's denied even to prayer.
I love it. I love Twain. Oh, my God, I love Twain.
Well, I'll tell you, somebody who thinks very highly of you, which is the reason that I called, and that is Ray Taliaferro in San Francisco, who I listen to nearly every night, because if I want, you know, the real truth, I tune you and Ray in. And a couple of nights ago, I think it was, you were talking about a general strike, and you were pointing out that it was a safe thing to do, a very potent thing to do, you know, hit them in the pocketbook as well as make a massive statement,
right.
Because you can't, you know, it's passive resistance at its finest, and what can people do to you? You're doing nothing.
Nothing, right, exactly.
And so Ray has been talking about this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him and asked him if, you know, just here I am out here, just a person, I want to do something, I'm an activist, so, hey, you know, I want to do something, and I'm so damn frustrated, pardon me, my French here, with the Democrats, like you sound like you are, I want to do something, so.
You can say the word damn on this program, Carol.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Okay. All right, so what did Ray say?
He said, I love Mike Malloy. Well, I'm paraphrasing. He said, I think Mike listens to me. And then he went on for 20 minutes about how he's contacting people who are going to try to put this into effect, a general strike where people just get up and go out in the street and stand there for 15 minutes to an hour sometime in the fall after everybody comes back from vacation.
Yeah, just to do nothing. I mean, it doesn't even require a Gandhian moment or a Martin Luther King moment.
Right.
All it requires, I guess, is for people to wake up in the morning and just stay home.
Yes. He is talking about going out and standing on the street.
I like that better.
Yeah. He's even talking about having, you know, photographs from space. He's really, really thinking about this, and I don't know who he's contacting, but I was hoping maybe you and he were coordinating efforts in some way.
No, not at all. I've been aware of Ray Taliaferro's show for, oh my God, since I was a teenager. I used to listen to him online. I've never heard him over the radio because, you know, he's in San Francisco.
Right, he's on KGO in San Francisco.
Right, but he, I've kind of followed what he's about and what he talks about because at one time there were maybe only five or six of us who could be called liberals who were on the air. Ray's been on forever.
Yes, he has.
And back in the day when there were six, seven, eight, maybe ten liberals on air nationwide, Ray was one of them. He was one of the trailblazers.
Right.
So I have an awful lot of respect for the man. And keep me posted on what he's talking about at KGO, and maybe, you know, maybe something will come out of it.
Well, why the heck don't you, can I say it? Why the hell don't you email him? Mike?
That would be a good idea.
And talk to him about it, because he is really stoked. I mean, Ray is like you. He's got people all stacked up.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do call him a lot, and I really try to be concise because I know he's got all these people. This time, he talked for 20 minutes about it, and he's really, I think, really trying to do something. And I think having support from you or someone who he respects, and he said he did. He knows it.
Well, I'll tell you what. All right, here's a little mini assignment for you. All you have to do is you find his email for me and send it to me.
RayTal.com.
RayTal.com. That's it?
RayTal.com and also KGO.com.
Oh, that's his website. All right. Well, I can get his email there. All right.
Yeah,
well,
you can.
You know, I just may do it. I just may do it.
Because the whole idea is coordinating this. I mean, who does it? MoveOn.org? Me? Carol? I don't think so. You know, it's got to, some people got to get together and do this thing. I live in San Francisco, and I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. And I interview a lot of people. I went around on the street that day, and I talked to 50 to 75 people. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Bush's ratings are 17%, but in San Francisco, that's 3%. No one said no to it. Everyone.
It's easy. It would be an easy thing to do. It doesn't require people to travel. It doesn't require people to clump up together and take the risk of being gassed by Bush's Gestapo. All it requires people doing is, I like Ray's idea, just making an appearance someplace and stopping. And just, I don't know, sit down on the sidewalk, feed a pigeon or kill a pigeon. You know, just do something that amounts to nothing.
He wants people to go out, this is the way he's described it, go out on the street from work,
mm-hmm.
from shopping,
from school.
Home, from school, and stand there. For a period of time, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, long enough so those little helicopters that frequently fly overhead can take pictures of it for the news.
Right.
And, you know, that's what he's envisioning. And it hits people in the pocketbook. You want it to cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what he's talking about. You know,
mm-hmm.
you go out, you leave work, it's costing money. You don't shop. It's costing money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you walk out of stores, it's costing money. So a presence, a statement. Oh, and also one of the people I spoke with in a store where I was talking about this said he made an excellent suggestion. Don't make this about getting rid of George Bush because you want to pull in everyone, Republicans and Democrats,
right.
and across the spectrum. Focus it specifically on getting the F-bomb out of Iraq.
Exactly.
And not killing more people in Iraq and in, you know, in American soldiers. And what do you think of this, Mike? I have thought on many occasions, and Ray said something about this the other night, that what Bush is trying to do is kill as many people as possible everywhere in the world so that there's a smaller population so that it's easier for his ilk to control the situation.
I wouldn't be surprised, and it looks like they're taking on the Ruskies again now, too. Hey, listen, Carol, I got a boogie. Thank you. I will get in touch with Ray. I'll figure out a way to do it. I'll go to raytel.com. Thanks, Carol. I think it's a good idea. General strike is certainly not my idea, and it's not Ray's idea, but it's been talked about by a lot of people who... who've been begging, pleading with America to do something. Just do something. And if doing something means doing nothing, there's something incredibly zen about that, and I think it's a good idea. Dave is calling from Oklahoma. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, how
are
you doing?
Do you have me on a speakerphone?
No.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, I was just, the reason I called is I was listening to the people, you know, complaining about the war,
mm-hmm.
saying we should get out.
Right.
It's like, well, I guess one of the first thing that occurred to me is, like, they're saying we should get out because of all the people who are being killed, which, for them, that's not good, but basically, a lot of them are in that because that's what they want to do.
Well, now, wait a second.
They want to jump out of planes. They want to shoot people. They want to blow things up, and that's where you do it, in the military.
Well,
and if there wasn't a war, then they'd be sitting home going, oh, man, this is a drag. I'm just, like, wasting my time here.
Now, how did you arrive at this conclusion?
I talked to people in the military who say, we love going over there. I mean...
Oh, come on, Dave, you know, it's one thing, to call the program with nonsense, but it's something else again to expect people to believe the nonsense. Dave, thanks for checking in. Just, I don't know what to tell you, pal. I just don't know what to tell you. I really don't. Good luck with all that, and, keep me posted. Let me know how your life goes, okay? No, on second thought, don't. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Going to work, don't want to go, feeling low down. bring the home, you start to roam, then you're in town. Everybody knows there's nothing doing, everything is closed, it's like a ruin. Everyone you see is half asleep, and you're on your own, you're in the street. After a while, you start to smile, now you feel cool. Then you decide to take a walk by the old school. Nothing has changed, it's still the same. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
It's okay, Republicans. The pain will be over soon. Take a deep breath. Find your happy place. It's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 9 before the hour. Phil is calling from San Diego. Phil, welcome to the program. Hey, Phil. Hey, Phil. All right, put Phil back on hold. We'll come back to him later. Jude is calling from Seattle. Hey, Jude, welcome to the program.
Hey, hello, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, I've been very, very quiet today because I knew after listening to a lady last night that I was supposed to call tonight.
Uh-oh, what happened?
Well, no, I just knew. She ended up calling about peace, and it was, the intention, I think part of the intention was there, but we started a movement up here, and it's kind of a synchronicity with what's been going on in your program, although I only heard since I've been on hold, because I don't get you till later tonight.
Mm-hmm.
But we started a movement called Women Standing, and
it's called Women's what?
Women Standing.
Standing, okay.
Correct. And I know that there's all sorts of different titles, but it happened after I talked to you last August, and the whole program was just so shrouded because there was so much sadness, and
mm-hmm.
I ended up pulling a copy of the paper from the New York Times about a mother and a baby that were dug out of Lebanon, and you had spoken about that night. In fact, you lost all your power in your control room, and you could see Kathy out there, and there was light, and you yelled out, "Hey, Jude," and I said, "I'm here."
Yeah, I remember. That was right before I got fired from Air America.
Oh.
Yeah.
Didn't know the timing of that.
Yeah, it was last August.
Well, if I may, I want to go back to the last show. If there's any way that you can hear what Jeff Farias did with a woman called Sophia, it would really behoove you to pull that up.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't so much just the subject matter, but it was the time allowed. And there were numerous people that I spoke to independently after that program, and all of them experienced the same thing. Mm-hmm. It was like a shift in consciousness. And
wow.
She talked about... she has a sweet tone, and sometimes people turn that off because they think individuals have no substance. But, you know, we just have to be who we are.
Mm-hmm.
But she spoke that, you know, about the revolution happening within ourselves. And after I spoke with you in August, I call and I write and I, you know, did all sorts of things. But I was literally taken out of my house, and I was put on an overpass in Seattle, and I stood there with another woman, and I've been doing it since August. And what it is, it's for literally that we create within ourselves, because women have been gifted with, creation to bring life forth. So it became kind of a manifestation of being like a ciborium or a chalice. And during that period of time, we aligned with one another and also opened up ourselves to house as much peace as possible. Well, since then, I have no website. I'm just a humble journeyer. You know, I've heard on talk radio, there was a gal from Portland, Maine. They started a Women's Standing.
Uh-huh.
There's a group in Oklahoma. There's two separate groups here in Washington and a group down in San Diego. And we're finding that the quality of the women's lives are changing, and that men are also beginning to join. And all we do is hold white flowers, and we, for that hour or 2 hours or 15 minutes, we just become that presence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a very interactive dynamic.
Well, that might be the kind of energy necessary for a general strike.
Well, you know, and what I had to do, Mike, when it came about was the fact that I couldn't align with anything that had a negative, you know, because the polarities are so strong right now. I wanted to be in a place and to be open to guide, I mean, and not that I have any answers by any means, but I had been given this, and the women and the men. I had a young gentleman, a precious soul, come up to me 2 days ago because I stand on the corner here sometimes just with my white flowers, and I carry them wherever I go. And he said, would you ever be wanting to come and be with me during Women's Standing? He says, Jude, I've been wanting to do it for months. I thought it was only for men. You know, Gandhi, you mentioned Gandhi earlier. You know, the essence of nonviolence, individuals, it really requires a humility and an understanding. And where we are with mind and intellect, we're trying to figure out, understand, discern, we have to move beyond it. We incorporate it. And it's like when you talk about your experiences with Molly,
mm-hmm.
that place that you go to her is sacred and pure and good.
Right.
That's where we need to live. We need to have the fight, have all of that. But women, you know, mothers and sisters and daughters, they're a precious element on the world, in the earth. And my kids would protect me mm-hmm. to their life. And all I do is stand.
I hear you. Well, it's an excellent idea, Jude. It really is. I don't know that I, as an individual, though, I've said this many times on this program, I don't know that I'm evolved enough or have control enough or lack of control, whatever, however you want to look at it, to transcend my... And I blame it on my heritage, my Italian, Irish kind of emotional spider web. I probably would have been one of the people back in the late 40s in India who would have said to Gandhi, you're crazier than hell, you know, take up a gun and shoot the bastards. I probably would have. I probably would have said to Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. King, no, don't sit there. They're coming with the fire hoses. Arm yourself. I just, I had somebody tell me one time I was a young, very young soul and hadn't evolved to the point where I could handle stuff like that. Now, I don't believe in that nonsense, but it was interesting that the person would qualify me or classify me as a young soul, which apparently is, if you believe that stuff, is somebody who just doesn't have a grip yet. I don't have a grip. I think you do, Jude, and I wish you the best, man. I really do. And I hope a lot of people would join Women Standing. There's another group, Women in Black. I'm all for it. Me? I still struggle too much. Welcome back, 7 past the hour. My name is Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network. By the way, Nova M founding members, if you're not out and about tonight, you can join the live chat at novamradio.com. Just go to the website, novamradio.com, and click on the chat button and enter your username and password. And You can talk and rage and scream and flirt among yourselves. Billy Foster, who normally monitors the chat room, hangs out in there, is producing or engineering for us tonight at KPHX, our usual helmsman. Ian is a little under the weather tonight. That's such a nice thing about Nova M Radio, or KPHX, both, because we're interchangeable, is the fact that so many of the people here can do so many different jobs. Of course, that's necessary because we're still a very small, we're a very small network. How many people we have work for this network, Abby? Four?
I'm baking cakes and making coffee.
I know,
and,
I know.
Painting the building right now.
Never mind, never mind. But anyway, when you call in tonight, say hi to Billy. And Ian will be back as soon as he's out from under the weather. All right, back to your phone calls. Jake is calling from Arcata, California. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
It's going fine. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah, I'd just like to pass along my message to the so-called leadership of the Democratic Party. You know, you only had 14 senators vote against his blank check for Bush and his idiotic war.
Yeah.
You had 86 Democrats in the House voting for this, you know, to give Bush exactly what he wanted with no timelines at all and bring the troops home.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the best we, you know, the Democratic Party can do, then clearly the Democratic Party needs new leadership. And I would suggest we start with Harry Reid, kick his butt out of there. And I think Russ Feingold will make a good replacement.
Yeah, I'm as disappointed in what the Democrat, almost said a Republican, not there's that much difference for some of them, but I am disappointed. I know it's a cliche to say that they're just you know, two sides of the same coin. By the same token, there are Democrats who are truly, truly not just the other side of the Republican coin, but there are Democrats with whom I have just given up. I mean, I can't stand it anymore. I try to avoid the topic, believe it or not, because it just gets me infuriated to think that the people that you and I and 20 or 30 million, 40, 50 million other Americans decided to put in office or put back in office against real challenges by this right-wing noise machine, those people are not doing what we had in mind. Now, maybe it's our fault for not clearly articulating, look, we will vote for you, but issue number one is to stop this occupation. Get the hell out of Iraq. Bring our troops home. Maybe it rests on us. I don't know. But surely the people we've elected know now how the vast majority of Americans feel. So I don't know, Jake, it's something that just gets me extremely, extremely, A, pissed off, B, confused, and C, ready to join a different political party.
Well, I understand that, Mike. And, you know, what I would say to the, you know, the Democratic leaders is just look at the exit polls from last year's election.
Yeah,
the
really?
Top two issues, number one, getting out of Iraq. Number two, stopping this corruption in Washington, D.C. But what do we see? We see that the corruption in D.C. inside the Democratic Party, taking all this money from the so-called defense industry, let's call them what they are, you know, merchants of death,
sure,
the Lockheed Martins and Boeings and all these companies that are making a killing off of the killing. These people are giving money to Democrats, and look how they're voting. It's the corruption that's keeping the war going. This entire effort is corrupt from the start. It's all based on lies, based on a bunch of Nazis in the White House who weren't even elected in the first place. We really do need a change in the Democratic Party. That means this leadership's got to go.
I hear you. I hear you. Jake, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in, as always. I got to share this with you from Jody in Arlington Heights near Chicago. Hi, Mike. I'm listening to last night's show. Yes, I'm a Finders Club member, and I heard you talking about Ohio Governor Strickland's letters to the maniac-in-chief regarding his National Guard be fully trained and supplied. Well, the supplemental funding bill for Iraq, also known as the Democratic Yellow-Bellied Unaccountability Act, contains a portion that was meant to address that very area. The law states that it is the Department of Defense policy to not deploy units until they are, quote, fully mission capable, end quote, meaning they have the training to perform the mission under conditions expected. If they are not fully mission capable, then no funding shall be used to deploy a unit. Sounds good, right? Seems there would be no need for Governor Strickland's letters, but just one guess, Mike, as to who gets the final say in deploying units, combat ready or not. I quote from Section D or Paragraph D, quote, the President, by certifying in writing to the Committees on Appropriations and the Committee on Armed Services that the deployment to Iraq of a unit that is not assessed fully mission-capable is required for reasons of national security, and by submitting along with the certification of a report in classified and unclassified form detailing the particular reason or reasons why the unit's deployment is necessary, may waive the limitation prescribed. End quote. This is like a signing statement, truth seekers, okay? Jody goes on. So the idiots continue to put power over the lives of our fellow citizens in the hands of a madman. Those hands should not only be tied, they should be in a straitjacket. His chest-thumping, I am the president rant should show us that. Why would anyone with any true patriotism continue to allow this madman the control he has and continues to grab for himself the power? I have recently had conversations, quote-quote, with conservative friends about the war, and they still support this rat. When I have been, shall we say, disrespectful to the president, I was told, he's still the president. When I told another that she would have to one day admit she was and is wrong, she said she never would. They cannot and will not ever admit they were wrong, because then, of course, they would be forced to assess the stand they have taken, and it would not be pretty. Thanks for your ranting. Sometimes it gives me a boost to fight on, but not today. Today, all I can think about is the people who will be thrown into the combat zone, untrained and unsupplied. And Bush will do with Ohio Governor Strickland's letters the same as he has done with every citizen's pleas for an end to this war, just as he does the lives to be sent to fight. Throw them away. Jody in Arlington Heights. Back to your phone calls. Tim is calling from Los Angeles. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Mike Don. How are you doing?
Doing fine, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you. You know, there's one thing I noticed, especially listening or actually listening to you reading Milo Freeman's story.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's not only is it powerful, but I'm realizing that there was an awakening. And I noticed this two other times, too, with a friend of mine who used to be this hardcore, she used to be a hardcore conservative Republican.
Uh-huh.
But then she changed. She said, I seen the light. I don't like this war. I don't like Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And she listens to you religiously now.
Oh, bless her heart.
And also,
I don't think that the attitude that right-wing Republicans or Republicans in general try to sustain can be sustained, because if Republicans continue to follow their mindset, then eventually down that road lies some form of a mental breakdown. It may not be the, you know, the gibbering, foaming, put him in a straitjacket kind of mental breakdown, but it will be a mental breakdown where they can't relate to their family. They can't relate to their spouse, their children, if they have any. They can't relate to their home, to their co-workers. They can't relate to their parents if they're living. You can't continue to be a Republican. One can't continue to be a Republican and maintain sanity. It can't be done because of Bush. There was a time, honest to God, Tim, there was a time when people in this country could be Republicans and still be sane. But that time is gone. It's absolutely gone. So I'm glad your friend has had a chance to have this awakening. I really am. Tim, I got to leave there. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Pella. Thanks, Mike.
All right, appreciate you checking in. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
A rocking horse, people eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you.
Don't be left out.
Join your friends at the NSA and Homeland Security and listen to Mike Malloy every single night. They never miss a minute.
Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Oh.
You'll be all alone.
How does that one make you feel, truth seekers? If you're just joining us, we're playing for bumper music tonight from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the album that was released by the Beatles 40 years ago today, June 1st, 1967. Astonishing, isn't it? Isn't getting old fun? It takes courage. I had there was a time when I really hoped that my old age would contain someone, even on a remote basis, a peripheral basis, someone like John Lennon. The night he was shot, the night he was gunned down, it was unbelievable to me. And you know what's ironic? Kathy. Kathy, which one did you take swimming lessons from at the Decatur, Georgia YMCA?
Captain Nemo.
Captain Nemo was...
Mark David Chapman.
The one who shot...
one who killed John Lennon.
The irony here, and Kathy and I have talked about this several times, Mark David Chapman lived... He lived in the Atlanta area for a while, right?
When I was a kid...
Yeah, he did. And he was a swimming instructor at the Decatur, Georgia YMCA, right?
Yeah, at the summer camp program. He wasn't, I don't think he was like full-time on their regular year-round staff, but during the summer camp, he was a swim instructor during the summer camp program at the Decatur DeKalb Y. And for one summer, he taught us little kiddies how to swim, and everybody loved Captain Nemo.
And when you found out that your former swimming instructor at the YMCA summer camp was John Lennon's assassin...
I was kind of freaky. I didn't know right away because we didn't know him by Mark David Chapman. We all just called him Captain Nemo. And he was in the
20s. That's the character from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea,
right?
Yeah,
and that's what he called himself. And he may have said, my name's Mark, call me Captain Nemo. I don't even remember because I was like 8 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so, you know, we're talking like 10 years after that.
Right.
And, I just remember the chills that I got when I heard the news report and they said, you know, when they were starting to get into the bio information on this guy, like later that night, you know, early the next day when they were talking about him and they said... You know, taught swimming lessons at the YMCA in Decatur, Georgia. And, and I thought, oh, that's the same guy.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's about 25 past the hour. Excuse me. Evan is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Evan, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
How's it going tonight?
It's going fine.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't know if you heard the good news tonight about Tim Griffin being forced to resign.
Yeah, he was the Rove buddy in Arkansas who was appointed the federal attorney. We're going to try to get Greg Palast on the program early next week to really get into that. I had the story. Yes, Evan, and I wanted to talk about it, but I would rather do it with Greg on the program because, I mean, he's the man, right?
True, yeah.
Right, he's the man. Greg Palast is the man.
He's the man, that's right. And you know, I was listening, I caught a bit of your show yesterday, and you mentioned, you said something along the lines of you are a racist. And I think you have a. I'm not sure exactly how you put it.
Well, let me just explain it. I'm a white male in America. This is where I was born and raised. I have a racist element that was put in me from day one. I struggle against it. I constantly fight. I have fought against it for most of my adult life. And by adult life, I mean going back to the time I was about 16 years old, and I was in high school, and we discussed one day the murder of Medgar. The young boy in Mississippi who was Emmett Till, right? Who was murdered for allegedly, the way the rumor goes, for looking at a white woman, although that is that's in dispute. So from that time on, I've tried to struggle against the racism that was put into me, the way it was put into every white person in America. And I maintain that every white person in America is basically a racist. Now, a lot of us struggle against it and try to overcome it, but it's in there. Hold on a second, Evan. I got to take a break here. We'll come back right after the break. This is Nova M. I'm Mike Malloy.
The Mike Malloy Show on Nova M Radio. Talk radio matters here.
Welcome back. 25 before the hour. We're talking with Evan in Raleigh. All right, Evan. I really piss off white people when I say that. When I say that to be white in America in 2007, above a certain age. I'm not going to talk about people, teenagers or people in their early 20s. Maybe they've had a different experience. But you get above a certain age in this country, say, just for arbitrarily, say around 35. If you're a white person over the age of 35, you have been conditioned to accept racism without even thinking about it. And for white people who can handle that reality and then work to overcome it, well, fine, no problem. But that's what I meant. If that's what you're asking me when you said, that I said I was a racist. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
well, the reason that I mentioned that is because in my own head, and it's really funny, it's strange, but in my own head, in my mind, you actually, I don't know if you would take this as a compliment or not, but you remind me of Malcolm X before the trip to Mecca. In my own head, that's my own comparison of you.
Yikes. Now, I don't know how to take that, because it was not until he went to Mecca that he realized the sanctity of every human being. Malcolm X, by his own admission, if you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, which I'm sure you're referring to, he admits he was flat-out racist. And not because he was raised that way, but because the society had made him into one. Red. They used to call him Red. And what he was turned into. I guess that's what you mean. What do you mean?
Well, that in terms of your just ferociousness, first time I ever heard you was when you sat in for Randy Rhoads one day,
mm-hmm.
and I heard you completely by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, who in the world is this?
Yeah, who's this freak? Right.
And why is this guy, they put this guy on in broad daylight?
right out in front of his mama and everybody, right.
And yeah, but that was the tone reminded me of Malcolm X. As a matter of fact, when I first heard that Chuck D was going to be mm-hmm. on Air America Radio,
right.
I expected his show to sound more like what yours sounds like.
Yeah, I understand that.
Rather disappointed on that note. But mm-hmm. I mean, I still listen, I still like them and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But like I was saying, you remind me of Malcolm X before the trip to Mecca. And another weird thing is, when I think of Tom Hartman, because I listen to his show quite a bit too,
mm-hmm.
I think of him as Malcolm X after the trip to Mecca.
That's interesting. I'm probably going to see Tom in July. I'm going to go to Seattle for the station up there is putting together an event that they had, similar to an event that they had, I think, about a year and a half ago. And I think I'm going to see Tom there. I'll mention that to him because, you know, as soon as you say that, I think you're probably on to something. It's difficult. It is difficult being white and being conscious in this society. It really is. And any white person who disagrees with that is, as far as I'm concerned, just in my little universe, is deluding himself or herself. If there's ever going to be a solution to just the major problem in this country internally, which is our racism, if there's ever going to be a solution, it's going to take people to just face it. I mean, damn, just face it and be honest with it and say, okay, just be honest with it. And very few of us are able to do that. The only reason I think I can do it is because I've had some good teachers. I've had some people who have gotten kind of brutal with me and made me confront some of my belief systems or some of my ideas about what America is. And
well,
this
comparison was uncomfortable for me to come to
mm-hmm.
because, you know, after all, you are two white guys. And
right.
I think it's odd. Of course, there's Cornel West and there's Michael Eric Dyson out there.
Right.
But it's interesting that two white men would in my own head, you know, represent that.
I can understand what you're saying. Sure. I can understand what you're saying. Yeah, it is. It is. And I kind of like the idea that you consider me pre-Mecca. All right, thanks for checking in, Evan.
Yep.
All right, take care. I can't wait till I see Hartman. And just say, you are post-Mecca, I am pre-Mecca. But he's right. He's absolutely right. Hartman is a lot more mellow than I am. He really is. You know, I know Tom. I think I know him. I know him on a professional level, certainly. I have great respect for his intellect, his ability, his professionalism. He is an excellent author, talk show host. I have a lot of respect for Tom. The times that I have been around him, and they have been fleeting because it's usually at an event where you know, he is a guest, I'm a guest, Randy may be there. Stephanie may be there, Stephanie Miller. You know, just depends on who is summoned. So our back and forth, Tom's and mine, has just by circumstance been kind of brief. He was in New York the night about a week after I got fired, when I went up there and broke into the studio and went on Sam Cedar's program. He was on right before me, wasn't he, Kathy? And he was there as an invited guest. I was there as breaking and entering. And after he stuck around, afterwards we walked out onto, what is that, Broadway? Is that Lower Broadway? Where the Air America studios are? And it was like, you know, it was very late at night. I don't know, it was midnight, 11 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, something seemed very late. And we walked up to the bus stop or the subway stop, you know, just kind of chatting. And in that regard, you know, I've known Tom, I've seen him around, we've chatted, but Tom is Tom goes for the mind. He uses the best arguments known to man to convince people, and he's got a lot of patience. I go for the gut, and which is, you know, I'm not saying one way is better or not so good. Although I do, there's a part of me that does believe that Tom Hartman is a more evolved soul than I am, because he has the ability to kind of sort through and not lose his temper. Of course, Hartman, that's not an Italian name, isn't it? What is Hartman? Hartman, what is it? I'll pass that on, Evan. Back to your phone calls. Phil is calling from San Diego. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening, Mike.
Hey.
Thanks for letting me have a reprieve. I was with my dogs
sure.
earlier.
Yeah, I know. We tried to get you on, and there was nothing there, but that's cool. That's right. You're back.
Evan, yeah, he's right on about, I'm glad you're doing, giving Greg Palast the due that he deserves. He's a super patriot to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I called that number, and apparently they're listening to us, John Conyers especially, you know, the 202-225.
Right,
I mean,
right.
224-5225.
Right.
The thing I was going to say about was about earlier the woman was talking about Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to mention what comes before Gandhi. Gone C and gone B, gone Cheney and gone Bush, hopefully. And in regards to earlier in the week, Mr. you know, Shrub had his press conference, and he was saying all of this concern that he had, kept saying concern about Taliban and concern about Al-Qaeda. And,
right, right.
I mean, why didn't he just say Neil concerned?
All right.
I really appreciate you being there. To me, you're like a breath of
fresh air.
Truth air.
A candle in the darkness, right?
Yeah, man.
I like that one. A candle in the darkness. That's always been one of my favorites. Hey, there's no difference between you and me, Phil, except I've got the microphone. That's all.
And you're playing the music that is just so truthful. I mean, it's like what they said is so prophetic today. You know, it's prescient. I mean,
I know. So much of the music written in the 60s by Lennon McCartney, by the Stones, by whomever, was really a prescient music. It was a predictive music, and here we are. Phil, I got to leave it there. Thanks for checking
in,
pal.
Happy weekend.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And to see you're really only very small, I float on the finger as without you.
After listening to some of this album today, I had to go buy some inkjet cartridges and some fax paper. So I took Division Bell with me. Not going to suck me into that 40-year hole. No. It was a great album. It was an interesting time, 1967. I say interesting. I don't say good or bad, but it certainly was not the best Beatle album. I don't think it was what it was. I tend to go with the White Album, but Sergeant Pepper's certainly twisted everything, didn't it, or untwisted it? One of the two. Thanks to Billy Foster, who engineered the program and sat in Ian's chair. He answered your calls. He is also the moderator at the NovaMRadio.com chat room. Thanks to Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Mark Marshall, our webmaster, the moderators at MikeMolloy.com on the message board, and also Catherine Bay, she who must be obeyed, the executive producer of this program. Back to your phone calls. Gary is calling from Corydon, Indiana. Corydon, is that right?
Corydon.
Corydon.
Yeah. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing all right, Gary.
I had to work this week at the night, which I don't usually have to do, so I didn't get to hear your shows and find out whether you had said anything about the National Security Directive.
Oh, yeah. We talked about it this week and I believe a little bit last week, how Bush has consolidated, or thinks he has, with his directive, all the power, so that the next time an event occurs in this country, he's the man.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, do you honestly believe that he's going to try and do that? Or do you think that he's just going to, you know, that there's actually going to be an election and he'll leave office?
That's the $64,000 question, isn't it, Gary?
I mean, I'm just curious what other people think, because I think there won't be an election. I think he's going to try and take power.
Well, I kind of fluctuate back and forth between that and thinking, no, as mad as these people are, they understand that in the first place, I don't think the military would allow it. I think there would be a bloodless military coup in this country. I don't think the American people would allow it. And I, you know, as much as they talk about Karl Rove and the rest of these freaks being political genii, they're not. They're half-wits. They're pedestrian. They represent what Hannah Arendt talked about, the banality of evil. And they're cowards. So I don't think they'll make a power grab. However, I do believe it's certainly within the realm of possibility that they will engineer another event like they engineered on September 11th, 2001. Listen, Gary, there's an awful lot of noise coming in. Are you on the road?
No.
Where's that noise coming from? God, that's you're blowing our transmitter. The transmitters.
I have no idea. This may be a bad connection. I don't know.
Well, that could be.
You sound fine coming this in, but that don't necessarily mean it. You know.
That's right. All right, now that's better. All right, where were we? Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask. You know, the what you was talking about earlier with what's that dude's name? Evan.
Uh-huh.
About racism.
Right.
And you were talking about of a certain age. I guess maybe I'm 39.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I guess maybe in my case it might be just a tad bit different because it's a relatively small town.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I started kindergarten and there was, you know, my best friend at that time was a little black girl.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, we grew up together.
Well, a lot of white people had that experience, but that doesn't speak to the larger society that determined a long time ago that wealth in this country was going to be white wealth for white people was going to be built on the backs of slaves. I can appreciate what you're saying. I went to elementary school and high school with black kids. It doesn't make any difference. I had a lot of black friends. Doesn't make any difference. Racism is something that is essential. By that I mean it's laid in there on an essential level before people like you and me are able even to independently think. It's not a conscious choice. I don't think white people consciously choose to be racist over a certain age, and you certainly qualify. I think anybody over the age of 35, I don't think we consciously choose to be racist. We add to the racism that's put in there before we even are able to define what racism is. That's my point. I've had black friends all my life. My best friend as an adult until he died for 9 years was a comedian named Steve Smith, who happened to be black. And Steve and I used to, we had the kind of conversations that most white people can only dream about with a black man. It was just no holds barred. He was my best friend. I would have done anything for Steve. He would have done anything for me. I would have protected his family. He would have protected mine. I mean, on and on and on. That doesn't matter. I still approached that relationship with Steve as a racist. I hope that I can overcome it before I die. I don't think so. But you know what? Being consciously aware of it is part of overcoming it. And that's kind of what you know, what it's all about. Gary, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal.
Have a good night.
All right, sir. Appreciate it. Hey, everybody, have a good weekend, all right? I appreciate your participation in the program all week. I'll see you Monday night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look, having read.